Greetings, citizen. Welcome to the show, and thank you for listening. For more of the Art of Wargaming in your life, definitely check us out on Instagram and Facebook. If you'd like to support the show, we have a Patreon account where you can do just that for as little as $1 a month. What we can offer will expand as the show does. If you don't have extra funds but would still like to help us out, you can give us a like, share, or 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. Want to get in touch? Feel free to message us or hit up our email, artofwargamingpodcast@gmail.com. We look forward to continuing the conversation with you because we know the world is vast, with many different ideas on tactics and strategy that can be applied to the games we enjoy.
You're listening to the Art of Wargaming on the EarFirm Network. On War.
Welcome to the Art of Wargaming on the EarFirm Network. I am Yaga Malark. Today we will be talking about the cordon and the key. But before we get into that, I wanted to show some gratitude. It's been a while. I meant to do this a few episodes ago, and it just fell under my radar. But I've been meaning for a while to say thank you, and to extend my gratitude to each and every single one of you who is listening to this show all over the world. You make this this job easy. You make me want to get in front of the microphone and speak because, my goodness, it is just so meaningful for me to have all of you participating in this. So thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm going to actually list off all of the countries that that we're being listened to in, that we're a part of this big community. But before that, I just want to say some numbers. That first number I want to say is 30,465. 30,465 downloads. Guys, that's amazing. Thank you so much. That is a massive outpouring. I never thought that I would ever see that kind of support. So, I mean, thank you so much. And I hope every single one of those downloads has been able to give you something, has been able to add to your life in some way, because that's why I do this. I want to make sure that this information means something to every single person who listens to it. And also, before we name off the countries, because that's the last thing, it's going to take a second, there's a lot of them, I want to say a special shout out to those who are supporting us on Patreon. You make this happen. You help fund what we're doing, and most importantly, you help fund me going to events. This particular year, I'm going to get to go back to Chaos Wars, the event that I started going to years ago and that I haven't been able to go to for years, but they changed the time of it. And so at this point in the year, there's not going to be as many bugs or mosquitoes. They're going to eat me alive. So I get to go again, and y'all are helping me do it. So let's say a big thank you to Edmea Rebecca, Dennis Stone, Catherine Chouinard, Charles Coup de Soleil, Shelby Johns, Adrian Bashaw, William Milligan, and Sean Kinzel. Guys, you are absolutely amazing. So when those interviews come in from me being able to talk some folks at Chaos Wars, I need you to remember that you made this happen. And again, you have my heartfelt gratitude for helping us do that. But now that, when I went on to check how many countries we were listened to in, I was expecting 20, maybe 20. But guys, oh my gosh, so many here. I honestly think we are listened to in more countries than we are not. So check it out. I'm going to list them right now. All right. Chile, China, Colombia, Croatia, Czechia, the Dominican Republic, Ethiopia, Micronesia, Finland, Georgia, Hong Kong, India, Israel, Kazakhstan, Lebanon, Mali, Mexico, Nepal, Pakistan, Poland, Russia, the USA, the UK, Canada, Germany, Australia, Sweden, France, Denmark, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Spain, Norway, Hungary, Iran, Italy, Kenya, Luxembourg, Malta, Montenegro, the Netherlands, Peru, Puerto Rico, Saudi Arabia, Austria, Greece, Portugal, Romania, Thailand, Albania, Argentina, Bangladesh, Belarus and Belgium, Brazil, Iceland and Ireland, Japan, Kuwait, Malaysia, Mauritius, Morocco and New Zealand, the Philippines, Lithuania, Serbia, Singapore, Slovakia, Slovenia, South Africa, South Korea, Spain, Switzerland, Syria, Taiwan, Tunisia, and Turkey. That is 78 countries. That is amazing. So, all over the world. And for every single person, I say thank you. Thank you for listening. And I look forward to being able to present to you more quality material, more quality analysis in the years to come on some of these books, and finally mix it up a little bit when we finish Clausewitz. So once we get past this one, we're going to start getting into some other ideas and maybe even some asymmetric warfare stuff or alternative things. We're going to go crazy with it, guys. So thank you again for listening, and let's dive right in and talk about the cordon and the key. A defensive cordon, while not being the most glamorous of military operations, is often an extremely important and vital one. A cordon, which is a C-O-R-D-O-N, is basically any defensive plan that is supposed to cover an entire district directly. And when we say directly, we are hearkening back to when we spoke of direct defense, being there at the time, stopping our opponent, or at least interacting with them where they are. And so we have a couple of different ways of establishing a cordon and different ways of using this idea of a cordon, which is, like we say, a defensive plan to cover a large area, a district, if you will. And a district can be, you know, as big or as small as we want to. Julius Caesar had a famous cordon when he was going against the Gauls and his campaigns. Now, he did a double cordon because he did the one going in towards the city and another one on the outside stopping the relief force from coming in. It really was a brilliant move, and I know that at some point we're going to end up studying that just because it was absolutely brilliant. But we have three different ways of doing this. And the first one is to do a direct defense in a line of posts. And this is in a more open area that we can think about. This is temporary, these ones. And the object of this is to absorb a weak blow. A cordon does not work against the strong portion of our enemy's army. That's not what it's supposed to do. And it is a mistake to try to use it that way. We're not trying to make every single point of the cordon strong and able to resist. This is not an impenetrable defense. This is a zone of control. It's zone defense, if you will, if you enjoy football. So a good example of this is if you have opponents that have taken to a city, for instance. Let's talk about the kind of warfare that is imbalanced, the kind of warfare where you have one side that is way stronger than the other, and one has gone into a city and the other one sets up a cordon around said city or around a place in the city where they know those folks are. The point isn't to necessarily stop them entirely from doing a strong motion. We know that they're weaker than us. It's to put the squeeze on them to make sure that they stay where we want them or stay out of where we don't want them. So that's that kind of cordon. The second one is what we would call lines. And these are permanent defenses that control entry to a country. And this is, you know, kind of can go back and forth there. A good example of this would be the Manuel line in France that existed to the north there. And at this time in Europe, Clausewitz knew about all sorts of different lines, all sorts of different areas where you had a permanent cordon that had been established. And again, these are not made to check a major operation. They're not made to stop the entire enemy army, and therefore they are given a small garrison, because to try to be super strong everywhere is to be weak everywhere. And so the idea is to have this cordon set up and be able to react to what is going on. So we have our larger defensive force stationed somewhere behind the line, in a better camp sort of area that can support a large number of people. And then if the cordon is threatened at one way or another, we're able to go after it. We're able to intercept it. And the cordon at that point acts as kind of a speed bump, making sure that the enemy's force cannot go very quickly through where we are, but making sure that we are situated to be able to reinforce. It is not enough just to be behind the lines. It needs to be in a convenient place where we can get to point A, B, or C, depending on where our opponent might be coming from. Another type, and the third type of a cordon, is the extended lines of outposts that we use temporarily around our army to cover the flanks. Now, these are important. And again, they are not there to stop the enemy army. If we were to have a major movement on one of our flanks, our cordon is not there to stop them. It is there to stop raiders, saboteurs, and other such small groups that may be trying to infiltrate into our camp, check small actions that are coming against it. Of course, that's absolutely why it's there. But we can't trust on it to defend us against absolutely everything. And so against the main body of the opposing army, this is again a delaying tactic. It gives us a chance to react. It gives us a chance to form up and resituate wherever we need to be. To not have a defensive cordon when we're camping is foolish, because then our opponent can be wherever they want to be. And this allows us to observe the enemy as well, and to observe our own weak points. And so it may seem superfluous in some cases, but because the art of war is about deception, we can never count on the fact of our enemy being where we want them to be, doing exactly what we want them to be doing, because our enemy is not an AI that allows itself to be manipulated. Our enemy is not a predictable thing. It is another human being, our enemy. And they're going to think like we do. They're going to be trying to outwit us as we are trying to outwit them. And so a cordon is a good way to anticipate, or rather prepare, for an eventuality in deception. Now let's talk about mountainous country and cordons, because, as we've talked about in previous episodes, mountainous country always has its own rules. It breaks them from everything else. And mountainous country, we can say two different statements that are absolutely true. In mountainous country, a cordon may be more extended and dispersed than it would be on level ground. But we can also say that in mountainous country, the cordon must be more dispersed and more expansive than when we're dealing with level ground. So let's talk about both of those words, may and must. It may because the terrain already augments our defense. When we're dealing with that kind of broken up, the ridges, the defiles, anything that prevents our opponent from being able to move well through the area, well, that's free defense. We don't really need as many outposts in that area because we know that our opponent, especially if we're dealing with something in Clausewitz's time, where the armies were large and unwieldy in mountainous areas, it's a pretty safe bet that we can use the mountain as a defensive thing. So we are able, we may spread out more, but we also must spread out more because we are considering lines of retreat. Remember that when we're dealing with the attack and the defense, well, when we're dealing with open country and most other kinds of country, the defense is far stronger. But in mountainous areas, the attack is far stronger. And so we want that cordon existing behind us, not just to give us a heads up if there's going to be some issue there, but also to give us a better line of retreat should we need it. That is also a point of a cordon, because it's just a line of defensive outposts that kind of controlled an area. And so if we're making sure that we control our line of retreat, it will be more useful to us should we need to use it. Now, if we're dealing with flat ground, we can't spread out as much when it's level. And also our force dispersion has to be far more significant, far more concentrated in one given area, because the rules are different in that particular thing. It's more about mobility than it is about hard stops. It's about really checking the opponent and making sure. So in review of cordons, we have to understand that cordons are not used to stop every blow. Even though cordons do constitute a direct defense, it is not an absolute defense in any means. It is a matter of controlling the zone and being aware of where our opponent is going to be. Zone control, like I said. A good example of this is in Warhammer 40K, when you're going against units that are very mobile, particularly if they deep strike. Now, for those of you who may not play Warhammer 40K, a deep strike ability is one that allows a unit to come in off of the field onto the board, typically more than 9 inches away from any enemy unit that is out there. Now, there are specific rules and little tweaks with certain armies where they can occasionally come in within 6 inches or 3 inches, but there's often limitations there too. And so if you're going against an army like the Grey Knights, which is what my buddy Todo and Kaji play, or if you're going against Blood Angels or Demons, which is what TF plays, all these zippy guys, well, then making a defensive cordon is what we would call bubbling. And the bubbling is being in such a way, arraying your forces in such a way that there are no gaps for your opponent to come in through. There is no really danger in our back line because we're not leaving enough space for our opponent to deep strike in. And so by bubbling, we are establishing a form of cordon. So if you play Warhammer 40K and you do that, you're already using this particular theory, just with your units in a slightly different way. But it's kind of the same idea. Area control, area denial, and speed bumps. And it really works well against an inferior enemy, because if we have the cordon and it cannot be breached by our enemy because they are too weak to do so, we don't have to worry about that. We can just control the area. However, we need to make sure that the cordon doesn't make us cocky, because it can also be a very risky maneuver depending on where our opponent is and what their plans are. So constant observation of the opponent, making sure that this is not a mistake, is very important as well. Because like we were talking about with Julius Caesar, he got hit by a relief force. Now, he managed to pull a double cordon and have like a circumvallation sort of defense put up as well that managed to work. But that is a rarity in the history of the world, in the history of warfare. Caesar was one of the few to actually pull that move off. And so that's one of the weaknesses of the cordon, is if a force comes from an area that is unexpected, if a relief force comes and hits us at an angle that we were not anticipating, a cordon can be very, very, very damaging to us because we're very spread out at that point. So this is something that we have to take into consideration when we are considering using a cordon. Now we come to the idea of the key of the country. And no, this is not a physical object that unlocks a mystical box and that allows us to be get a crown and become the king or queen or monarch of a certain country. No. The key of the country is that we are going back to the idea of the coup d'etat. And this was something we spoke about when we talked about Frederick, and we've talked about it a few other times too, but it's the ability to look at an area, look at a situation, and know what needs to be done. And know where the weak points are, know where the strong positions are, know who needs to move up and what needs to come back. That is the coup d'etat, taking it all in at once and being able to process it. And finding the key of the country is really linked to that idea of coup d'etat, that idea of being able to see, because a lot of times when we're dealing with this, we don't have time for analysis. We have time to consult with the other generals to make a quote-unquote educated opinion. It's a matter of making an opinion now and needing it to be a good one. So when we're dealing with the key of the country, it can be one of actually two completely opposite things, really. The key of the country can be any spot that you wouldn't want to advance into that country without that spot. It's a complicated way of saying it. But if there's a place in this area that, if we don't have it, we don't want to invade, that spot is a key of the country. The other kind are points that decide possession of that area. Now, these are related, but they're not the same. And so there's a lot of different things that can give us this key of the country, as you can imagine, when we think back through all the different scenarios that we've studied, through all the different terrain types that we have studied throughout this, there are definitely certain areas that would qualify as keys to a country, but it's always different. I can't sit here and tell you that where roads meet up is always going to be the key to the country, because there's other factors. How thick is the woods? Are there woods around? Are there mountainous areas around? What's the nearest large body of water? What's the direction of our opponent coming at us? You know, these are all things that matter when we're dealing with the keys to a country. But there are certain things that seem to be a commonality. And it doesn't really matter when or what kind of forces we've been dealing with. The high ground is significant. Those of you who watch Star Wars or are on the internet at all will know about the high ground. And it is important. It's important for several reasons. Of course, it's important because it gives us the point of observation. We can see. It gives us momentum. So if we need to move against our opponent, we already have the force of momentum on our side. It makes our opponent have to work harder to get at us. So there's a lot of good things about high country. And that has been the way for as long as we can remember, since we've been riding horses and shooting bows and arrows, to when artillery was king at this particular time, to even now. We see, especially when we're dealing with said artillery and forward observation posts, we study the war in Ukraine here because that's one of the things that's going on at the time of this recording. But as they're moving through areas, commanding the heights is important. One of the guys that I listen to rather religiously, Dennis, he is always showing topographical maps as well. Like, he'll show us the above and see, like, okay, this is where they're advancing. And then he'll turn it and show the levels, show us the actual terrain there. And you can see, oh, that's why that little spur exists in that line. It's not because they just jumped through this opening and now have this nasty little bulge, as it were, that needs to be dealt with. But they're on like a mountain ridge. And they've moved forward and have a forward position with further artillery on this mountain ridge. And so high ground has always been important. And that doesn't take Kudel to see, right? Battle of Gettysburg, high ground, very important. Every battle. We can also think of the key to the country as a place where either there are the most resources or the resources come and go from that area. So you can think about major ports, farmlands, large wooded areas in this particular case, if we're dealing with trying to make bridges or palisades. So resources are also important. And depending on how plentiful they are and what kind they are and the needs of our army, that can also constitute part of the key of the country, is the control of those things. Of course, well-situated forts. We have talked before about fortresses being ways of also doing some area control, being staging grounds for supply for armies. So forts are also important. And if they are situated correctly, they may also prove to be keys of the country. They may be something that we don't want to move past to get into that country without possessing it. The mouths of rivers are also very important. Think of forts that are positioned on the mouths of rivers. We had a few here in America. And during the Revolutionary War, they were hard. They were hard nuts to crack. Because they had, of course, protection of the main water nearby, but they also controlled that area. The movement up and down the river was at the beck and call, the behest of that particular city. So the mouths of rivers, also very key areas to try to go after. Any sort of significant settlement or city nearby. And then, of course, major bridges, major ways of crossing through things that would be otherwise difficult or impossible to cross through. These are all examples of keys of the country, but like I said, it really depends. It really depends on the situation, on your army, your opponent's army, and this takes a bit of Kudel. This takes understanding of the opportunities as they may arise to us. Hearkening back, that if we're going to use a cordon, to do so wisely, to make sure that it is not putting us at risk, and to make sure that we understand that it is not there to stop a major blow, but to stop minor blows and give us preparation, give us time to respond to a larger blow. And this can be made easier if we understand the keys to the country, everything we've learned so far about this movement and momentum and terrain, that all coalesces into the idea of the key of the country, understanding where we need to be and when we need to be there. And as Miyamaru Masashi would say, it takes experience to understand.
That's our show. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't had enough of the Art of Wargaming in your life, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram, where I occasionally post funny and educational memes. If you want to get in touch with the show directly, you can email us at artofwargamingpodcast@gmail.com with any questions, comments, or concerns that you might have. Also be sure to check out all of our sister shows on the Earworm Network, including General Nerdery, Word Balloons, Fried Squirms, and more. We're working hard on having something for everyone. And again, you can find those at earworm.com. That's EARVVYRM. You can also find that in the show notes. But for now, this has been Yagamalark, signing off.